building plots. And that's what's getting me. I've seen so many public interest and political situations dissolve around indiscipline. So I really think that that's a challenge. Self-assessment is such a situation. And we have to be willing to say there are some humanities that are in the right humanities and if we want to appeal to people, and persuade people, we need to get to the computer. They live in all kinds of families, but they live in family, even if it's a navigation street. Yeah, I mean, it really, I think that what you're saying is scary if they didn't get behind the language to a set of principles. But it is not scary that they finally are focusing on this as a policy concern.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's important to feminists to adopt the word family, you know, using that kind of language, is that I think that so many women have felt locked out of what we're called a women's movement, because I think if they are homemakers or they're not really careers for the women's movement is not investing in the field. And I think that we can't be afraid to say that, you know, we're concerned with family values, we're concerned with the quality of life. What do you choose to be at home and make it want to be at home? We have to take those things back.
Yeah, but I just to put this into our perspective on it. Well, I love family, and I think family issues, not simply your own children, but your friends can take it as your family. I love my kids dearly, and I still think it's a part of my family.
That's really good.
Isn't that nice? Yes, you tell it now. You tell it now. But the reason we lost those words were not because I'm thinking I'm going to lose a short sight of me, because women were equated with family. You know, women did not have an identity independent of the institution. So that the initial reaction against family for white women was to say, we, or middle class white women, was to say, we have a right to exist outside of this context. All our decisions don't need to be for the good of the family. The self-abnegation kind of role of the person was that. That woman needs to help advocate her own needs so that she can, take care of other people. But what happens in that is that for many women, the activism that they're taking part in is really for the family, for those values that are there. Also, it brings us to something else, which is we're talking right now in connection to the language of self-advocacy, which is the language that I think is dominant in a lot of professional industries. We have a right to be what we want to be. Most women, are not self-advocates. They're survivors. That you've got to get out there and we've got to work. That the modern American family, whatever that family is, both people working or one person working will settle in. I mean, it now takes almost two people to earn enough money, you know, to once was once a single wage earning income. I mean, the reality is that lots of women are out there killing themselves.
You know, I think that none of us wants to be ahistorical, and I also think that it is true in the Black movement, it's true in any movement for change, that there is some pendulum effect that is between out, perhaps they push the outer limits of the rhetoric, and they push the outer limits of what constitutes the development of the movement before there's some readjustment back to more inclusive language. So women's movement ought not be faulted for what in the beginning it thought it had to do in order to stake out the territory. I mean, you know, that's cool. But what troubles me is that we have a learning that we have of the man. You know, I don't want to deal with 1960. You know, I don't want to deal with Betty Man and all that. I want to deal with 1985 and crisis. See, and I do not accept the platitudinous, garbage that's going to, if we care about all women, then damn it, let all women be put forward as part of the leadership structure. If we don't, then let's stop pretending. Let's say this is the white middle class women's movement, and y'all do your thing. And that's what's happening, and that's dangerous to me. I'm troubled by that, because we don't need to fight each other.
Yeah.
There should be something else happening. So, I do agree with you about the historical antecedent. what I find incredible is that you are short-sighted then. I mean, you know, that's what you had to do, the rest control of the argument. Now you've gotten control, there's nobody who questions the legitimacy of the women's movement. That's, you know, that's not a question. They may disagree profoundly with what emerges, but not that they still, and I would say in the 60s, that would have been viewed as, that women's organizing was viewed with horror, I mean, or ridicule. So things have changed.
Well, and they also have changed, well, let me just answer that, in that the attempt to appropriate that to family, and now, like the Ellen Smeal, as president, they elected the House much, who are the people most interested in getting a PhD, but they elected this Pittsburgh housewife because they wanted to put forth an image of, you know, work against an image of religious and professional women. But I think it is true that when you hear the word family, people in this room have a textbook view, where I think we're not doing well in public education, but selling it to people. You know, when I read the second stage, she talked about homosexual families, she talked about single-armed families, she talked about communal families, she talked about every, there was a sentence, it was the most representative book I've ever read, there was a sentence for every potential view of family you possibly have. But you know what? You finish the book and you want to go back to suburbia with Wally and Cleaver, you know, the whole bit. That's what we've got to move. We've got to talk about family, but do a better job of talking about family in some different way. And I'm not kidding when I talk about my sister. As a single person, there's a sense of legitimacy in the family. So I'm traveling so all the time. She's much younger than I am. And I like to get a cut rate on Amtrak every once in a while and say, well, is this, are the two of you family? And I said, yes. And they think she's my daughter. And then they'll give me a ticket. Well, I said, yes, she's my sister. They said, oh. Now that we have such a narrow view of a family.
I appreciate this issue of family versus non-family, but I wonder what happens in a situation such as something that's really found out only by the end of the country, not even sure what passport or college, not all relevant to 1985. That
leads me squarely into the discussion of what I think is happening with Carol Bellamy versus Andy Farrell versus Tony DeFeo. What the issue of coalitions, as I said initially, involves a kind of mutual respect and a kind of lack of self-indulgence that I don't see as often as I would think. So what happens is that everybody says, okay, regardless of the context, if it's my turn, that means I'm taking my turn. And I don't really care about what havoc I may wreak for everybody else. If it's my turn, I'm taking my turn. Carol Bellamy, from my perspective, made some very significant tactical errors that almost ruled her out as a candidate that Blacks and to some degree Hispanics could support. And I hope that white women in the city do not misinterpret the lack of support for Carol Bellamy as a lack of support for white women as candidates. A lot of their lack of support of Carol Bellamy is grounded in things that Carol Bellamy did or did not do, and that some significant things, including supporting Koch for Bellamy. And I mean, you know, so it is not an a-contextual analysis that makes it impossible to Carol Bellamy. It has to do with that. And she acknowledges, by the way, the tactical mistakes that she's made in some areas, but I think she underestimates the extraordinary significance that people attach to. And with regard to Herman Badillo as opposed to Diddy Farrell, there's an issue here. If Basil Patterson had continued his original discussion about candidacy to an actual candidacy, I think that things would have been vastly different, because Basil had assiduously courted the coalition and the coalition participants for years and years and years. And it was always understood that Blacks in the city had earned the right to finally field a candidate. That's that history. When Basil dropped out of it, instead of people in the potential coalition remembering that this was the modus vivendi, they began to look at it as a wide open situation, and Herman Badillo was particularly guilty of that. Then, you see, he began to feel and suggest that Blacks would swing to him as the most viable candidate without really bothering to consult in a serious way. First. That set up the conflict. That set up the conflict because Blacks were pissed off that Badillo would think that this was an invitation to the club. Hispanics were pissed off because they needed to turn it into a much more violent campaign, and they thought that Blacks already were to sacrifice their interests for the greater good of the coalition. And it's real messy. It's real messy. I mean, but it's not based just on that. It's based on all other things.
What about multiple issues that sort of keep in the future kind of one or the other? When you talk about not living in the 60s, a lot of the bodies being here, and supposedly one goal is to do something like the Bureau's amount of support for terms of action for the voters.
I mean, that's just my personal feeling. issues in this particular townhouse, I'm not sure, at least initially, will have the effect of galvanizing people and making them come together. And that's why Ed Koch would probably be the mayor of New York in 1986. I mean, I don't know what else to say except that I still hold to the concept that issues ought to be and can be and often are the factor. But I think that New York in some respects is anomalous in that.
Let me raise the issue parallel in a kind of a way, in a kind of question that's expressed by our agenda on. And it misses some underlying truth. The women's vote is not about women voting for women's candidates. The black vote is about black voting and black candidates, Hispanic, mobile, and Hispanic candidates. But that is a lesson for Jared Burns. It's also a lesson about the race, but I don't want to come back to it. But Carol Bellamy has a constituency that's an intriguing constituency. I don't know what Diane Feinstein says or doesn't say doesn't mean that Carol Bellamy doesn't support the black movement. I think she was the obvious support, but that is her support base, that is an interesting stratum. But that's not the same kind of constituency building as geographically based or that class-based or ethnically based that is historic organizing in New York. And what will happen when Carol, if Carol, doesn't do well, is that people will say, well, you see, the women's vote is important because, after all, it couldn't elect Carol Bellamy. I think the issue will then become how different, aside from the hardcore people who really know Ed Koch, with the exception of the Amy Cady contingent, how different are Carol Bellamy and Ed Koch to most people? How much differentiated are they? Is there some of this problem where there's a rhetoric of exchange, but in fact, I would make the analysis of the debate where you had Mondale saying that he discovered the new conservative realism. He's got new fiscal realism. And he is going to be strong with the Russians. And Ronald Reagan hasn't discovered fiscal realism. He's invented fiscal realism. And he is tough with the Russians. That if you're going to make those remarks of the debate as a public speaker, it's going to be very hard to mobilize. And Carol, who I think has a lot of latent support among certain people, will get that support, but doesn't have a broader base right now because of history. I think that's true enough. Because a certain kind of coalition building that this city needs. That doesn't mean, however, that she is not a worthy candidate or that she would be a terrific mayor. Nor does that mean that a woman's role won't play a part. I'm just going to get more support from them than possible.
But it sounds like what you're both saying is that since Carol Bellamy is a really conscious probability anyway,
By the way, I have not gone on with my good plan.
But if the women's vote doesn't bring Carol Bellamy through, then she might as well vote for issues and more conscious probability of those issues that way. It sounds like that's what you wrote that I would gain from what you said.
Well, I think that's true in part. What I was trying to say was that my analysis of Carol Bellamy's candidacy prospect is grounded in something quite different from either the women's vote per se or the issues that she might or might not bring about. And that is the anomaly of the that is New York. And that's why it's so dicey. And I want to say, by the way, that I am not a New York City voter, so I wouldn't have a chance to say anything. And I don't take a position that Carol Bellamy could be a worse name in the country. Quite contrary, that's why I made it very clear that I'm from the Aiden K school. But I still think that her particular candidacy in this context at this time is not only an improper test case for the women's vote per se, but it is also an improper test case for the viability of coalition because of certain historical realities that now shape people's view of Carol Bellamy, and it has nothing to do with her being a woman. That is really not even on the list for a lot of the people who are making the judgments that are negative. What is on the list are things like supporting cottage mayor, things like what happened with some of the commissioners and some of the agencies, things like what the role of the city council is viewed to be as opposed to what it's turned out to be in her leadership. Things, crass things like does she get released to some people as opposed to the others. I mean, it's a lot of other things, and that is what constitutes the ecology of this particular canvas.
In other words, she doesn't have the options that you're asking them to suggest that, how she should exercise. I mean,
to take Geraldine Ferraro's comment, when you see that, the things that Apple said there were very real about how the women vote played into that, how Geraldine Ferraro got away from issues that can be galvanizing the women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. See, there we could talk about the things I think you're asking us to talk about, but not, you know, and not in the Carol Bellamy situation. Now, it may change somewhat, but I don't really see it changing anything I've seen so far. And that's why I answered the question the way I did. By the way, the one other thing I think is important, you know, see, even as we talk about this issue, notice what we're saying. You know, black women are not monolithic either, but also they're not a part of what's considered the woman's vote. And therein lies,
therein lies the lesson that you taught us.
Yeah.
Your lesson was, so long as you pitch this in a particular kind of way and make it a certain set of things, that there is no doubt in my mind, having listened to you, that the black woman's vote, if it goes to Carol, is going to be an ADK vote. And that it's probably going to go in some other direction because this ecology exists. See, so we are gone full circle, but because I've learned so much from what you said.
Let's talk a little bit about the material, because that's obviously a hidden share of building the future. I mean, if the unfortunate message is that the things that happened before, hopefully not so far before, but you know, are, then the time is now to look for 1990 and after. And this maturity needs to be in every element. It can't just be women, you know, understanding their solidarity with black men and also it has, and the whole sort of reorientation for white middle class women is kind of hard. I mean, first of all, I think what white middle class women have to do if they're going to be mature is to say, hey, I'm going to take a position on the terrain that those people have specified. Now that's a big shock for a lot of middle class white women to do. And when they do it, they may have a kind of converting experience, which is an altogether inappropriate way of saying, I'm going to go and join them, I'm going to, you know, which is not, I mean, the second stage of that maturity is that you've got to go there knowing that you are in some way part of this kind of a coalition with decided limits because you cannot substitute yourself for a black woman. And, I mean, this is tough, because you have to both have a new view of coalition. And you have to have the emotional resilience and self-knowledge to be able to go there and be rejected appropriately.
But you know, it's interesting what you said. It gives me an opening to what you do like that. And it's come up in a number of real firefights around coalitions. Blacks and Hispanics and Jewish community and some of the other middle class women versus women who have black men, women of color versus white men, blacks in general versus the other people, whatever. There are some flashpoints. One of the things that interests me about this whole area of critical maturity is that a lot of times the right people are not on the table. And people, who, and this goes back to Bill Bellamy and the whole question of history, sometimes people can no longer take a leadership role in building something new. They have to be mature to step aside and to support some new voices. And that is particularly in the organizational context, because I consider some of our leadership, the new Dixie Cats, you know how they used to send these guys, but once they got to sea, they died each sea. I mean, every 2 years, all it was a march out of the courthouse to send the same person back. So it is with many of the civil rights and other organizations. It's the same, well, therefore, no one hears them anymore. Because it's like you hear a steady state noise of a certain level of decibel for a certain period of time, you don't even notice that there's noise in it. And that's the same thing. The whole question of opening up political leadership to new voices is, I think, the critical test of political maturity at this point. And that cuts across the board. That goes to the question of integrating volunteerism. That goes to the question of bringing younger people into positions and mentoring with them so that they can become real contributors and real leaders. I mean, that goes across the board. And we are continually missing the boat on that whole question of really redefining leadership and finding new leadership in new places and elevating it to the level that it deserves so that it can be effective. In the question of issues, for example, when we set out to do this People's Platform, one of the hardest adjustments with this leadership that came out of the charismatic tradition was to recognize that they had to move over a couple of chairs and invite contender back to the table. Because the other side had already recognized that and was killing us with the analysis. When I used to be in the business of working in civil rights policy, and I wanted to find a definitive econometric model, economically based analysis of the benefits of affirmative action, I could not find it. And I could find all kinds of stuff about how affirmative action is responsible for productivity, workplace displacement, everything but ratings. Because I mean, that's the work, they did the work. And their technocratic input was elevated to a leadership position. So in our communities as well, we've got a lot of work to do. And part of it has to do with who it is that is really coming to forge this new agenda. And some of the old players can't do it. And to say that is not to disrespect. It is not to disrespect them and to deny their contributions. It's simply to recognize the nature of the issue.
Two questions. One is, even if you have power, I'm going to step down. They don't quite aren't as wise as we are to know that they should move on. And second, although oftentimes they are forced into that understanding, the second one is, I guess, I'm throwing out something that really worries me. We've talked about inclusion, we've talked about issues, we've talked about sharing experience, we've talked about confrontation, rejection, and all that. How does that happen in the reigning era when people are being encouraged to feel that it is okay to worry about themselves and not worry about other people? Where the assumption is government has done as much as it possibly can to help people and that we just can't afford it. That yes, it would be nice if we could do these things, but we can't afford it, and that's a legitimate response. And therefore, of course, it seems to me that in the past we're pushing people to examine these issues are not there.
Well, I think I was on the time instead on 60 Minutes last Sunday night. I never thought I'd quote her. But I thought it was very, very important, and that was that what the Reagan administration has done is make us comfortable with our babies. And so that I think answers the question you just raised. And it is, it's true. I didn't vote for it.
I don't have action.
But I know that. And I lost some of my drive and my willingness to be what I consider to be a good person, a balanced person, and seeing the other person die. And that's what he has done. And I think that's one of the general drifts in our culture, the political culture,
And may I say one more thing? You are so articulate, Brandon Farmer. It's incredible. And it's too bad that some of it, those who you would like to speak for us, for yourself, are not as articulate. And I'm thinking you said something about looking for an econometric study on something. Somebody had already done it, but not so that to find the things you wanted them to find. They beat us every single time. They know how to use the language, the vocabulary. And so these moral majority people, President Reagan, can say he's gone overboard when he said he felt like to support the American farmers, and he doesn't want to visit Dachau or Auschwitz or whatever when he goes to Germany in May. So, and we have forgotten that. We have forgotten what our language is. And it's not, we don't need new ideas, as you said, we were discussing the family with the woman from the National Green Political Caucus a few months ago. This is what we need to do, and you used to participate. Something important, it has been
trivialized. You can speak right here.
It's a bad habit.
See,
I'm really frustrated. Yeah. I'm frustrated
with us,
but I don't have
a
choice. And one of the things...
By the way, she doesn't
want to
be poor.
Right. No, no, I am poor, but I have potential. One of the things that I really was disappointed with the Democratic Party at during the convention, Cuomo's speech was perfect. The Democratic Party had followed that speech and his attempt to pull all elements of America together, black, white, people of color, old, young, middle-aged, he pulled together in that beautiful piece of rhetoric what most Americans hold dear. You know, where this is a very local country, we can all succeed together, we do not have to, you know, use the labors of one group to elevate ourselves to the detriment of that group. We can all go forward together, and I think the Democratic Party missed it by not addressing women's issues, but not calling them itself. These are human issues, and they cross the class lines, and they cross the ethnic and color line, because it is in our interest as a people that people have the opportunity to go to school, that they have the opportunity to use their talents as best they can.
What is this, I can see a lot of people that in fact, we've learned that somebody pays. Affirmative action means somebody to do a job. Now, I think means that the young white boy is the one that has to do a job. We've learned that you can't go to work with others. One, they will tell you to respond to poverty, and two, cost productivity, which means that inflation happens and that I pay in terms of the comfort that I live. But the premise that it was the New Deal, the ideas were not wrong. The implementation of
may
not have been correct, but it's erroneous to say that inflation was
wrong. I'm pushing you because this won't sell, is why I'm pushing you.
Now let me push you further. Name an energy that runs across class, race, everything. Give me that education.
All right.
Let's take education. People are saying education is not to tell them the handbasket, or that's like AT scores are finally gone. I mean, I don't believe I'm saying that. This is what, the SAT scores are finally gone up because the Reagan administration is too disciplined and cut back on all this stuff. All right? I just think it's important to understand that what you have said at another time has a different answer.
What you're saying is exactly what we have to say.
And we've got to have the discipline to push ourselves to be behind these works, as I was saying earlier, to look behind them and to come up with something that is not just visual.
But so you're talking about doing the legwork, the practical,
yeah, I mean,
the technical legwork.
The technical legwork is finding another language. That language is important.
Interjecting here. He would not take the vice presidential nomination. He's a smart politician. He'd co-op. He did not take it.
I'm sure that Walter Mondale would much prefer him to Geraldine Farrar or any woman candidate. He met him at the airport. Walter was going someplace, or co-op was going someplace. He's a smart politician. Hopefully he'll still be around and have some clout in 88. But he spoke that way, and people do that, I'm sure, at the convention. I was in Toronto. I just heard part of it. He spoke to them, but they knew here was this man, the politicians, and they knew. He knows we're not going to win in 84, and he's up there, and he's just talking. It's beautiful. But he's a smart enough politician not to get on the field. And I think that's
to lay the groundwork for 88.
Yes. Political maturity.
I don't really, maybe I'm not, this is not my field, but I really don't see a really big difference between that and JFK say the rising tide of political votes.
I mean, well,
And an issue like education, where you, according to the proposals, most of the people, you have 30%, 40% literacy in this country among adults. SAT scores don't mean that. I just think that we're...
Well, let me give you an interesting scenario. You know, in the give and take and push and shove of political people, the participants often lose sight of that. But it's really people that you're talking about. And I find that really interesting. I think I analogize earlier to the giant chessboard in the air. And all you have to do is move some pieces in there and something happens. There's a surrealistic quality to all of this for a lot of people because they feel that they are down on the ground. The hard edge realities of life, and it ain't no fun, and it's good of you to talk, but what the hell? And I think that where the Democrats went wrong was that they left themselves with bulldozers of this special interest label without recognizing that special interests are the special people and that there are people with special problems, and it is not wrong to point that out.
Well, also,
it's not democracy, because of special interest.
Really,
the military
tell me where any candidate said just that. They didn't. Everybody was so panicked by the big communicator in the sky that they ran for cover. They ran right into defeat. Because any time Prince Mondale finally got enough together to take Ronald Reagan on, people got all excited and were moved and fired up. Every time he played chicken shit on the edge of the cliff, he fell over. If he had gone on ahead and took the tough stance and took the tough and walked the tough line, he would have built his bridge over to at least a respectable choice. At a certain point, people want to feel that you're talking directly to them and understand who and what they are, where they live, what is it, and all the rhetoric in the world is going to change that if you run from the very people that you're trying to get to support you. And there's a legacy of bitterness there that's going to take a lot of political maturity to overcome. I tell you, the Democratic Party is deep trouble with black women, deep trouble. And, you know, part of the tension is trying to keep the positive things that Jesse Jackson did from evolving into some other kind of a more negative thing that really, in a sense, tears asunder whatever chance there are to work within the party. And I want to say that without being at all sanguine that the Democratic Party of yesterday is going to be a Democratic Party that I participate in tomorrow. because a part of what's happening is what I call the resurgence of.
I think the special interest question really sort of hits the nail on the head in terms of a lot of the topics you've been raising today. Because it's important, I think, for us to realize that movements aren't necessarily stigmatized as special interests. The civil rights movement of the 1960s had an appeal as a universalistic movement. It could not be stigmatized as a special interest. The labor movement of the 1930s had a universalistic appeal. The anti-war movement of the 60s and 70s, to some extent, had this universalistic appeal. Unless we try to realize why it is in the current political climate that even were we to string together this grand coalition of the left and these at the national level, chances are any candidate identified with that coalition could still get tagged as a special interest candidate and get nailed. That's why the one important reason why the Democrats are shifting to the right. There's a reality here. It's not just a psychological problem they have. The reality is, in fact, if you add up all those pieces, it doesn't amount to a majority yet. And we're facing a situation in the country today where we're in a profoundly depoliticized situation. Most women do not identify with the women's movement. Most working people do not identify with the labor movement. Reagan and the right have successfully managed to tag those movements as special interest movements.
You also aren't talking about movements in front of their organization.
True.
And I think that is an important part of other kinds of failure. This is not just the civil rights movement, because in this paper we're beginning the movement. But that the labor for women, for disabled, for the elderly, organization supported the candidate. There wasn't this kind of universalistic notion of what is the common good, the people working together and bringing in people from different other walks of life for that common good. It did not happen in that context, it happened in an interesting context. And the other thing is I think if you watch the polls throughout time, is that a continued concern. And you've got to remember, this is a fiscal crisis reaction. We've seen it in New York, and now we've seen it on the national level. How does one work with the common good? And that common good, somehow, and how one builds for the common good, has been capitalized by not talking about it.
Well, I think that there's another issue. And this is the issue that I think Rosemary is raising. It isn't just how do you work for the common good.
Find the common good, absolutely.
And because in the definition lies the next steps. And what's interesting to me is that Ronald Reagan has successfully, again and again, defined the common good in the most special interest, elitist, horrible terms imaginable, and he's gotten away.
But he's gotten a little bit more because of the nature of his
it's not, if it were just an economic issue, the people are also
accepting his agenda. We need all these trillions of dollars.
He also has the highest paid and most skilled public relations people in the country.
Right, come on.
I believe that, but I think we'll fool ourselves if we think that's a major explanation. And let me give you an example that has nothing to do with Ronald Reagan. And, you know, there just may be a lot of these male communicators around, but as a person who left in 1973 in New York City, and at that time just graduated from City College, and I lived in the Bronx, and I would take two fares to come in. This city had multiple public hospitals. I paid $57 a semester for college at City College. It had the best services I've ever seen in my life. And my biggest gripe when I was leaving was I couldn't pay the double fare from the Bronx to Manhattan because I'd have to take a bus and then a D train. And that, and then it's something like $1.25 or something. I don't remember what it was. I come back to a city in Minnesota that's unbelievable. You know, that people from the Bronx aren't even that wealthy. I mean, except for one in Riverdale, are paying $6 a day. Travel and then out of the city and have absorbed that cost because somehow God does not let them travel on the subway. They don't make that much money if God saves a lot of us. Hospitals have become much more privatized. Garbage collection is now privatized. More people go on a private street than I can imagine. I mean, I don't know how it's happened, but it's happening all over the place. And
rent.
Rent? Oh, God. Rent. Don't get me started. I'm telling you. That's my big beef. But moving back. This city has really been transformed. There's been major redefinition of expectations. And it's partly fiscal crisis mentality. When the city's going to go bankrupt, basically people say we've got to pull it together, work together, and understand we can't expect what we used to want. And now the challenge is, so what is it? We're not broke anymore. We even have a surplus in how we spend it. The politics will be fine. But I don't think that's just because Cox stuck with PR and is quite, you know, I'm told that he's flamboyant, he's got a great personality to find me, but I'm of the ABK school myself. But that's why I think we're fooling ourselves to think it's just PR.
No, it isn't, but you see, the issue is that one of the things that I found most fascinating and really most frightening about Rodney is that he is able to do a little soft shoe, smile a little smile, and everybody says, okay, if the president is saying this, then I can feel good. I can sleep safely. And I think that, you know, as a sort of closet romantic, the whole question of symbolism, how one trades the reality of life, is really very difficult.
And
we missed it. It's not irretrievable, though. And that's the discipline that I hope to be, and that's the good of maturation, and that's the challenge. The challenge is not to lay down and let it happen. Because, I mean, all of us have tire tracks from one end of that side to the other. Mm-hmm. And the challenge is, do you get up and go back and fight for what you know is a higher and greater good for your people? Or do you succumb? And I think the yuppie movement is full of succumbing. So the question is, where's the guts? Not where's the belief, but
where's the guts? Well, on that rousing line, may all have guts. May you all commit yourself to something greater than yourself, because you will all become better people for it. And I will greatly appreciate it.
But you'll be poor, too.
But I didn't exactly